Welcome to the second of our three Lionel Robbins lectures for this year by Professor Alan Blinder of Princeton, recent vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Professor Richard Layard introduced Professor Blinder yesterday, and so I'll introduce him very briefly for the newcomers today. I can't possibly give as an expert an economic analysis of his work as Professor Layard, but I did, when visiting America about 10 years ago, pick up what I thought was one of the best explanations of the American economy for non-economists, a book which I think reflects his personality and his works, Hard Heads, Soft Hearts, which is very much the right way round of getting thinking about economic policy. Yesterday, he told us what central bankers could learn from academics. Today, he's going to explore more what academics can learn from central bankers. Professor Blinder.
Thank you very much. Good evening. Yesterday, I spoke about the pervasive uncertainties that surround monetary policy, but in doing so, I swept one very basic issue completely under the rug, and that issue is, what is the policy lever? What instrument does the central bank actually control? The Tinbergen and Tile framework that I was speaking of yesterday simply elides one of the most enduring controversies in monetary theory by labeling some variables as targets and others as instruments, as if that were their birthright. Plainly, that is not the case. And in fact, central bankers all over the world can, indeed must, choose their policy instruments. So I'm going to begin tonight's lecture with a few thoughts on that choice. Although the ground is mostly well plowed, I'm going to try to introduce a few new thoughts in that context, by proposing an answer to a question that has long bedeviled both practitioners of monetary policy and academic students of monetary policy. The question being, how do you define a neutral monetary policy? How do you know when this lever is set to neutral? I'll come to that in a few moments. But the greater part of tonight's lecture will be devoted to an even more basic and contentious issue in monetary theory, which is whether it makes any sense to attempt discretionary monetary policy at all, rather than simply relying on a mechanical rule, the age-old debate of rules versus discretion. And here, as I hinted last night, and as Professor Hanna has just hinted again, I'm going to be sharply critical of what is by now a pretty large body of recent academic research on this issue, which has, in my view, made insufficient contact with reality. Well, let me start with the monetary instrument. In simple models, beginning with Poole's 1970 paper, the choice of a monetary instrument is often posed as a contest between the rate of interest, R, and the money supply, M. In the one case, R is the instrument, and M then becomes an endogenous variable, and in the other case, the two swap roles. Now, this dichotomy is, of course, too simple and too confining. In reality, there are more choices, including several different ways to define M. And indeed, if the central bank staff is imaginative enough, you can generate an unlimited number of definitions of M. And I believe the Federal Reserve in its history has done that, in fact. There are also many different choices of interest rates that one could target, not to mention bank reserves, the exchange rate, and so on. Furthermore, it is doubtful that any interesting definition of M or any interest rate beyond the overnight bank rate can be controlled very tightly over very short periods of time, like a day or a week. In the United States, the federal funds rate and bank reserves are probably the only viable options for time horizon, control horizons that short. But if you lengthen the control period and widen the control tolerances, many other variables, such as various definitions of M, become candidates, possible candidates. Now, let me just remind you briefly of Poole's basic conclusion and then go from there. The conclusion was that large LM shocks, shocks to money demand principally, militate in favor of targeting interest rates, while large IS shocks, shocks to consumption and investment behavior, and government spending, by the way, militate in favor of targeting the money supply. Subsequent to Poole's seminal paper, many monetary theorists devoted attention to the question he posed and tackled it in a variety of ways, and many papers were written on this subject. Much of that scholarly literature was worthwhile and intellectually fascinating. Some of it led to surprising conclusions. But in the end, I think it was real-world events and not monetary theory that decided the issue. Ferocious instabilities in estimated LM curves in the United States, the United Kingdom, and many other countries, beginning in the 1970s, say the mid-1970s, and continuing right up to the present day, led economists and policymakers alike to the conclusion that money supply targeting was simply not a viable strategy. A few facts about the U.S. monetary aggregates illustrate just how strong this evidence is. Surely the weakest possible version of monetarism must be the notion that money and nominal income are, in the technical jargon, co-integrated, which means they have a long-run tendency to stick together, statistically speaking. If there is no such long-run relationship, it's hard to imagine why anybody would be interested in M. Yet, a series of co-integration tests for M1 and nominal GDP on U.S. data, using rolling samples that begin in 1948, I think probably 48 quarter one, I don't quite remember anymore, and end at various dates, failed to reject the hypothesis that there's no co-integration as soon as the endpoint of the sample extends into the late 1970s. That is to say, M1 and nominal GDP are co-integrated, or tend to cling together, only for periods like, say, 1948 to 1975, and not since then, not if you let the data go beyond the mid-70s. Apparent co-integration between either M2 or M3 on the one hand and nominal GDP on the other does last longer, but it too disappears into a statistical black hole in the 1990s. And in fact, that evaluation is far too kind to M2 or M3 monetarism, because data limited to shorter periods like 1948 to 1980 fail to indicate any co-integrating relationship. So a co-integrating vector between either M2 or M3 and nominal GDP appears only when the sample is extended well into the 1980s, and then it disappears as soon as you bring in data from the 1990s. So in a word, there simply is no sturdy long-run statistical relationship between nominal GDP and any of the Federal Reserve's three official definitions of money for any sample that includes the 1990s. Because of stark facts like these, interest rate targeting won by default over money targeting in the United States and in other countries. In fact, it was Jerry Bowie, a former governor of the Bank of Canada, not of the Federal Reserve, who quipped, we didn't abandon the monetary aggregates, they abandoned us. And the kind of statistical non-evidence that I was citing is exactly what he meant by that. So this raises the question, was the theoretical literature on the choice of monetary instrument therefore useless to practitioners, an empty academic exercise? I think absolutely not. In fact, it's hard to think of an aspect of monetary policy in which theory and practice have interacted more fruitfully. Poole's conclusion back in 1970, in theory, was that instability in the LM curve should push central banks, if they were thinking clearly, toward targeting short-term interest rates. In practice, the LM curves in most countries did, in fact, become extremely unstable, and sure enough, one central bank after another abandoned any attempt to target the monetary aggregates. In the case of the Federal Reserve, the disengagement from the M's was gradual. After a rather tumultuous and not entirely successful experiment with monetarism between the years of late 1979 and the summer of 1982, the Fed began backing away from M1 targets already, as I said, in the summer of 1982. And by 1987, had already formally dropped any target for growth of M1 money, retaining at that time targets for M2 and M3 money, and especially retaining some subsidiary, at least, role in monetary policy formulation for M2 as late as 1992, but very subsidiary. Finally, in February 1993, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan announced in congressional testimony with magnificent understatement, as he often announced those things, that the Fed was, and I quote, giving less weight to monetary aggregates as guides to policy. I think when he said that, people in the academy and people in the financial market said, less weight? How about zero weight? Which is, in fact, what the Fed had been giving to the M's at the time and still is. So the interest rate, some concept of interest rate, let's just say interest rates won this contest by default. But that leaves the question, what interest rate should the monetary authority try to control? How should it try to do that, and can it succeed? Most empirically oriented economists would agree, I believe, with the following proposition, which rarely appears in economic theory, but occasionally does. And, more importantly, which seems to pose a serious dilemma for people who do monetary policy. And the statement is this, that the interest-sensitive components of aggregate demand react mainly to real long-term rates of interest, while the central bank can control only nominal short-term rates of interest. In other words, the interest rate that the central bank is able to control doesn't matter very much, and the rates that really matter are out of the central bank's control. On the surface, that appears to be a rather devastating conundrum. But I think things are not quite as bad as they seem. Note that this contrast draws two separate distinctions, one between nominal interest rates and real interest rates, and the other between short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates. Tonight, I'd like to focus on the real nominal distinction. So I hope you'll grant me the liberty, just for one evening, of proceeding under the assumption that the expectations theory of the term structure appropriately links long rates to short rates. A convenient fiction, by the way, that I will debunk thoroughly tomorrow. But I'd just like beg your indulgence to hold this assumption for one more evening. In the contemporary United States, as I mentioned, the federal funds rate is the Fed's central policy instrument. The federal funds rate, for those of you who don't know, is the overnight rate in the interbank market at which banks lend reserves to one another. But that rate, of course, is a nominal interest rate, which means that the FOMC must act nominal, set a nominal interest rate, while hopefully thinking in terms of a real interest rate. Fortunately, that little bit of mental gymnastics is not very hard to perform in the short run because inflationary expectations are very sluggish. On a day-to-day basis, you more or less know what they are. And so the Fed can be quite confident that when on a particular day it raises or lowers the nominal federal funds rate, it has raised or lowered the real federal funds rate by more or less the same amount. In the long run, however, telling the two apart, real from nominal, is not so simple. And mistakes, if not corrected, can be terribly damaging. The reason for that has been well known for years, and let me just review it with you briefly. Suppose that in choosing a nominal interest rate, the central bank mistakenly sets the real interest rate too high. An error like that, an excessively high real interest rate, will restrict aggregate demand, eventually opening up a GDP gap between potential and actual GDP, and then, with a lag, bringing inflation down. If the central bank then fails to adjust downward its nominal interest rate, as inflation is falling, the real interest rate will grow even larger, the restraint on aggregate demand will grow more serious, the GDP gap, will grow larger, and pretty soon, or eventually, I guess I should say, the economy gets put into a disinflationary tailspin. The opposite happens if the nominal interest rate is accidentally pegged at a level that makes real interest rates too low. And this was the case emphasized, for example, by Milton Friedman in the 1960s. In that case, the loose monetary policy eventually leads to an overshoot of potential GDP and thereby to higher inflation. If the central bank steadfastly holds the nominal interest rate fixed while inflation is rising, then the real interest rate falls even lower than it was. Aggregate demand becomes stimulated even more, and the economy is then off to the inflationary races. So it works both ways, and the moral of the story, or it fails both ways, I guess I should say, and the moral of the story is therefore simple. Stubbornly pegging the nominal interest rate while inflation is changing is likely to be hazardous to your economy's health. Before too long, the central bank must adjust nominal interest rates so as to guide real interest rates back toward their neutral setting. Did I say neutral? What does that mean? This is the point that I said I would get to in a few moments. And I'd like to pause briefly in this story to examine a concept that, while it has become prominent in the financial press in recent years, especially in America, but elsewhere as well, has no agreed-upon definition in academia that I'm aware of. And that concept is the neutral real rate of interest. So what I'd like to do is first propose a definition to you and then defend that proposed definition. So this is my proposed definition. At any moment of time, given all the standard determinants of aggregate demand, so that includes fiscal policy, the exchange rate, the spending propensities of consumers and investors, and so on, the economy will have some steady state IS curve. By that I mean the IS curve that will prevail once all the lags in the system have been worked out and provided that all the random shocks are set to zero. Specifically, I think it's maybe useful to put this up on the screen. Visible? Okay. If this is the IS curve, the regular IS curve, including the dependence of GDP on lagged values of GDP, as in a lag consumption function or an investment accelerator or a variety of things that lead to this, then what I mean by the steady state IS curve is just exactly this. Set lagged and current GDP equal to one another and zero out the random errors. So I call that the steady state IS curve and depict it in this graph. I propose to define the neutral real interest rate, R star, by the equation below, well, let me do here, that is R star is the real interest rate that along the steady state IS curve will produce potential GDP, or most easily thought of in this diagram as the intersection, the place where the steady state IS curve intersects the vertical line indicating potential GDP. This is the definition that I proposed to use. Now, note several critical aspects of this definition. First, if the real interest rate is below this neutral rate by this proposed definition, then aggregate demand will eventually exceed potential GDP, leading to higher inflation. Conversely, a real interest rate above this candidate definition of neutral will ultimately be disinflationary by precisely the same logic. So the proposed definition of the neutral real interest rate is oriented entirely toward the control of inflation, as seems appropriate given that price stability is the primary long-run responsibility of any central bank. According to this proposed definition, neutral monetary policy is consistent with constant inflation in the medium run. Any higher real interest rate constitutes tight money and will eventually imply falling inflation, And any lower real interest rate constitutes, by this definition, easy money and will signal eventually rising inflation. That's the first aspect of the definition. And indeed, why I propose the word neutral in this context. Second aspect of this definition that's worth noting is that the neutral real interest rate is not a fixed number. It will depend, among other things, on fiscal policy, the exchange rate, and any other permanent but not transitory shock to the IS curve, as you can see in this diagram. If you shift the IS curve permanently, not transitorily, for any reason, the neutral real interest rate will rise. For example, just take one concrete example, if the government moves to a more expansionary fiscal policy, permanently larger budget deficits, the neutral real interest rate of the central bank will therefore be higher on that account. Third, and implicit in what I just said about the fact that the neutral real interest rate is not a fixed number but can move through time, that rate, the neutral rate, is difficult to estimate and quite impossible to estimate, to know with precision. It is therefore, in my view, more useful to think of it as a concept rather than a number, a way of thinking about or conceptualizing what monetary policy is doing, rather than something that you might use as the basis for a mechanical rule, a formulaic representation of monetary policy setting the real interest rate. Nonetheless, I believe it is, I'm sure it is, an operational concept. It's not a purely ethereal concept. There are two main ways to get an estimate. One would be to do what this graph suggests in a more complicated version, solve a complete macroeconometric model explicitly for its neutral rate. And that's doable. Different econometric models will, of course, produce different numerical estimates, so it is wise and I think incumbent upon a practical central banker to use several alternative models. The second method is to compute the average ex post real interest rate over a long historical period. You don't need a model to do that. The idea here being not that you're trying to solve where the IS curve intersects potential GDP, but the idea being a simpler one that over very long periods of time, and I mean very long, lags work themselves out, transitory phenomena fade in importance, and random errors average to zero. And so if you look at the average position over a very long period of the real short-term interest rate, that should give you a good indication of the neutral rate. If you do that, however, it is very important not to use short periods of time that might be quite unrepresentative, such as the 1970s when real interest rates were often negative, or the 1980s when real interest rates were extraordinarily high. In operationalizing that concept, I always insist on using at least 40 years worth of data to compute the historical average. So my suggestion then is that central banks estimate the neutral real interest rate on a regular basis, and indeed a range may make more sense than a point estimate, and then use that estimate as the zero point to calibrate their monetary policy scale, just as we put a zero on the Fahrenheit and Celsius temperature scales. Any higher rate constitutes tight money. Any lower rate constitutes easy money. And furthermore, it's not just a high or low, it's a numerical scale. Higher the real interest rate, the tighter is money. The lower the real interest rate, the looser is money. And in the long run, neutrality is the only viable setting. And that's the important point. You must come back to neutral. Well, now that we have settled, or at least I have settled, on a monetary policy instrument, the estimated real short-term rate of interest, it's time to face up to the really big question that I posed at the outset of tonight's lecture. Should the central bank use its instrument, and I've just suggested what the instrument should be, but any instrument, actively to try to stabilize the macroeconomy or should it rely passively on a rule? Well, as I think most of you know, academic economists have long argued about whether central bankers practicing discretionary monetary policy should be, that is, would it be, should be replaced, meaning it would be in the public interest to replace them by a computer programmed to follow a mechanical rule. To my knowledge, practical central bankers have not joined that debate, presumably because they're sure they know the answer. And having been a central banker myself, I naturally take that side. But those of you here who know me and know my writings from my days before I learned the secret handshake will know that I also held that position before I was a central banker. Before proceeding further, I need to clarify, however, what I mean by a monetary policy rule so we at least know what the argument is about. The Tinbergen and Tile program that was discussed in yesterday's lecture will, if carried out, lead to a policy reaction function, a fact that was on the screen last night, relating the central bank's instrument to a variety of independent variables, most prominently the deviations of target variables from their desired levels. For example, the equation might have the overnight bank rate on the left-hand side and such items as inflation, unemployment, the exchange rate, or the current account deficit on the right-hand side. That is not what I mean when I talk about a monetary rule. Rather, to me, an equation like that is a mathematical and indeed somewhat allegorical representation of a central bank doing discretionary policy. It is the way an economist theorizing in the Tinbergen and Tile targets instruments framework imagines monetary policy to be made. To qualify as a rule, in my parlance, the equation, so to speak, for monetary policy must be simple and non-reactive or nearly non-reactive. Milton Friedman's famous K% growth rate rule for the money supply is the best known example. Pegging the exchange rate is another example. Holding the real short-term interest rate fixed at its neutral level no matter what would be a third example. There is, however, another case that has gained prominence in the theoretical literature. Assigning the central bank a rule based on outcomes, such as inflation, rather than a rule like Friedman's, which was based on instruments, such as the money supply. The two most obvious such rules based on outcomes are targeting inflation or targeting nominal GDP growth. And there is indeed an intellectual case for a central bank adopting a rule of this sort. In fact, some of those rules come fairly close to, and in a few cases, actually duplicate the legal mandates of central banks. The problem, then, is not that they're silly things to do, but they're not really rules at all, but rather objectives or targets that may require a great deal of discretion to achieve. A government that wants to, say, stabilize the inflation rate at 2% cannot replace its central bank by a computer and throw away the key. Reaching that 2% inflation target and then staying there is certain to require human judgment and adaptation to changing circumstances, things that computers are as yet not very good at. To wit, it requires discretionary applications of monetary policy. The harsh but simple fact is that no central bank directly, the adverb is important, directly controls inflation, unemployment, or nominal GDP, no matter how many economic theorists pretend otherwise. So to me, the operational question is, in terms of rules, would it be better to replace central bank discretion with a simple rule based on instruments that the bank can actually control, not on outcomes that it cannot control? Two very different lines of reasoning have been used to answer this question in the affirmative, that is to say, yes, you should so replace your central bank. The old-fashioned approach, is intimately linked to the name of Milton Friedman. Friedman and others argued years ago that the automatic servo mechanism of an unregulated economy will produce tolerably good, though not perfect, macroeconomic results. While activist stabilization policy might be able to improve upon these results in principle, followers of Friedman doubt that it will prove so efficacious in practice, because policymakers lack the knowledge, the competence, and maybe even the goodwill necessary to carry out the task. Faced with the choice between an imperfect economy and an imperfect government, Friedman and his followers opt with no hesitation for the former. They are far more sympathetic to the concerns of Lord Acton than to those of Lord Keynes. Now, I mention this older debate only not because I want to try to resolve it here or even opine on the matter, but only to contrast it with the newer version of the rules versus discretion debate, because these new arguments for rules take an entirely different tack. They are based neither on the ignorance nor the knavery of public officials, and in fact, in sharp contrast to that, assume that everyone knows how the economy operates, even the foolish government. Moreover, these models assume that the government's objectives are the people's objectives, and that everyone, even the government, has rational expectations. So these seem to be ideal circumstances for the application of intelligent policy. But despite that, the modern critics argue that a central bank left with discretion will err systematically in the direction of producing excessive inflation. And to remedy that distortion, they advocate replacing the central bank by a fixed rule. At least some of them do. This new round of discourse in the debate was initiated almost 20 years ago in a paper by Kidland and Prescott, who observed that the expectational Phillips curve poses a temptation to monetary authorities, specifically by stimulating aggregate demand and surprising the private sector with a little bit of unanticipated inflation. The central bank can engineer a transitory but genuine reduction in unemployment. Now, lower unemployment is valued in these models both by the public and by the central bank. They have the same objectives. So that seems good. The problem, however, is that you can go to this well only so often, and under rational expectations, not very often at all. If expectations are rational, people will understand the central bank's behavior, and monetary policy, therefore, cannot produce systematic gaps between actual and expected inflation. So a central bank that regularly and repeatedly reaches for such short-term gains will, on the average, produce more inflation but no more unemployment than a central bank that is more resolute. But any central bank that makes monetary policy on a period-by-period discretionary basis, Kidland and Prescott argued, will constantly face and presumably succumb to the temptation to reach for short-term gains. So they dubbed this an example of the problem of time inconsistency. And they suggested that the way to solve it is to tie the central banker's hands with a rule, such as, for example, Friedman's growth rate rule for money. A few years later, a series of papers by Barrow and Gordon, and also by Barrow writing alone, clarified that original message and extended it in a variety of ways, noting, among other things, that the rule could be reactive, and importantly, exploring the role of reputation as a way to produce less inflationary policy in repeated games. Their analyses spawned what turned out to be a cottage industry. I'm tempted to say a small cottage industry, but it grew to be a fairly large cottage industry, spinning theories of central bank behavior and offering remedies for the alleged inflationary bias of discretionary monetary policy. Now, when I was an academic, then and now, I found this analysis quite unpersuasive. And what I learned as a central banker strongly reinforced that view. And I'd like to take most of the rest of this evening's lecture to explain why. I have, in fact, three major and rather different objections. The first amounts to a long historical point, but an important one. With some variations in timing as you look across countries, the period from the mid-1960s to about 1980 was one of accelerating inflation in the industrialized world. Barrow and Gordon, writing in the early to mid-1980s, ignored the obvious practical explanations for this observed upsurge in inflation from the low inflation 60s to the high inflation 80s, things like the Vietnam War, the end of the Bretton Woods system, two OPEC shocks, which drove prices higher in all the industrial countries. They ignored all those things, and they sought instead a theoretical explanation for what they believed to be a systematic inflationary bias in the behavior of central banks. And they found it in Kidlin and Prescott's analysis of time inconsistency. But that was then, and this is now. Recent history has not been at all kind to the view that central banks have an inherent inflationary bias. In fact, the history of much of the industrial world, and indeed much of the non-industrial world, I might add, since about 1980, has been one of disinflation, not rising inflation, sometimes sharp disinflation, sometimes at excruciatingly high social cost. Furthermore, the monetary authorities in many of these countries, especially here in Europe, have displayed a willingness to maintain their tough anti-inflation stances to this very day, despite extremely low inflation and extremely high and persistently high, certainly by American standards, unemployment. See what the mention of high unemployment does to me. Whether or not you applaud these policies is irrelevant to the issue that I want to bring in front of your minds now. Whether or not you think the central banks did the right thing, these policies hardly look like central banks grabbing for short-term gains while ignoring the long-run costs of inflation. So how then are we to reconcile the disinflationary history of the period from roughly 1980, depending on which country you pick? In America, it would be 1979, as I guess it probably would be in Britain as well, to the present day. How are we to reconcile that with a theory that says central banks systematically, meaning always, produce too much inflation? My answer to that question is simple. We cannot reconcile the two. Nor can we dismiss the 1980 to 1996 period as a brief interlude of history, insufficiently long to be of interest. Because the period of history that Barrow and Gordon were pointing to as evidence, 1965 to 1980, was no longer. Furthermore, few theorists seem to have noticed the following embarrassing fact for the Barrow-Gordon theory. The theory predicts stable inflation that is too high. It does not predict accelerating inflation. What we had in the period 1965 to 1980 was not stable inflation that was too high, but accelerating inflation. So it doesn't even properly account for the period for which it was designed to account for. The real question about that period is not why the average rate of inflation was higher than it should be, though you could ask that question, but it's why inflation rose in so many countries more or less at once. So I'm tempted to conclude that Barrow and Gordon and their followers have been theorizing, and incorrectly theorizing at that, about the last war just as real-world central bankers were fighting the next war. In addition, it is worth noting, and important in historical context, that the real-world cure to this alleged inflation bias problem did not come from adopting rigid pre-commitment rules, as Kidlin and Prescott suggested. It came instead from determined but discretionary application of tight monetary policies. Rather than seeking short-term employment gains, central banks all over the rich world paid the price to disinflate. As in the Nike commercial, they just did it. My second objection to this line of theory is simpler and practical. Most of the literature presumes that the central bank controls either the inflation rate or the unemployment rate perfectly on a period-by-period basis. Obviously, as I said a few moments ago, that is not the case. Now, a theorist may argue, and most theorists would argue, that that's an inessential point. After all, no theory is meant to be literally true, and these aren't literally true. But I think that response dismisses the objection much too cavalierly. When the literature comes to discussing solutions to the problem, the alleged problem of inflationary bias, as I will in a moment, the arguments for simple rules based on outcomes, such as hold inflation to 2% or keep inflation at zero, or for certain incentive-based contracts that are allegedly make central bankers behave properly, and I'll come to those in a moment, either of those approaches in the literature hinge sensitively on the notion that either the central bank controls the inflation rate perfectly, or, if not, that shocks are perfectly verifiable ex post. Trust me, the real world is not that simple. When the inflation rate goes up or down, the public cannot be sure that the central bank did it. And indeed, the central bank is not sure either. There is no such thing as perfect ex post verifiability. My third objection will appear at first to be a very narrow technical detail, and I apologize, therefore, for the non-technicians in the audience, but in fact, it is not a narrow detail. And it will help to put up this one more equation. This will be the last. The literature derived from Barrow and Gordon's work posits a loss function in inflation, that's pi, and unemployment, that's u, that looks something like the equation on the board. So it's the square of the deviation of inflation from its target, and I take that target to be zero, and the square of the deviation of unemployment from its target, and I take, or Barrow and Gordon, I should say, take that target to be some parameter k smaller than 1 times u star, where u star is the natural rate of unemployment, the rate of unemployment at which inflation is stabilized. Oh, and the last thing I should mention is, of course, importantly, is that parameter alpha at the on the left-hand side, sorry, on the right-hand, the first symbol on the right-hand side of the equal sign is a taste or preference, a parameter indicating the degree of inflation aversion. Now, the parameter k is the one I want to focus on first. I'm going to say something about alpha a bit later, because that parameter turns out in the technical analysis of Barrow and Gordon to be essential, absolutely essential, to the argument for inflationary bias. In fact, the inflationary bias of discretionary policy in most variants of these models disappears entirely if you set k equal to 1. Now, I can assure you from firsthand experience that it would not surprise my central banker friends to learn that economic theories that model their behavior as seeking to drive unemployment below the natural rate, that is to k u star less than u star, then deduce that their policies will be too inflationary. They will not be a bit surprised. Furthermore, if that's the source of the problem, there is a disarmingly simple solution, which is simply to direct the central bank to shoot for U star, the natural rate of unemployment, as its target, not KU star. And that, frankly, is exactly what I felt duty-bound to do while I was vice chairman of the Federal Reserve. Much as I would have loved to see 2% unemployment in the United States, I felt that was way beyond my job description. And I should be shooting as a policymaker for the natural rate of unemployment and not lower. So it's a very simple instruction to give to the central bank, and one that I think many central bankers simply give to themselves. So having raised the three, what I think are quite fundamental objections to this line of theorizing, let me now examine the three proposed solutions to the inflationary bias problem that you find in the academic literature. In each case, my purpose is to match up the theory against what I believe to be the reality. The first solution hinges on notions of reputation. That's a concept, I can assure you, that is near and dear to the hearts of real central bankers. Here, the theorists have been barking up the right tree. Nonetheless, there's something peculiar about the way they've been barking, and that's what I want to say something about. Consider, for example, Barrow's 1986 model, in which the central banker is either a tough guy who will always opt for low inflation, or a wet who is willing to deviate from low inflation in order to boost employment, to reduce unemployment. In this model, the public doesn't know what kind of a central banker it actually has and is therefore forced into statistical inference. Watch what the central bank does and then make a judgment about what sort of central banker you actually have there. And therefore, if the central bank keeps inflation low, its reputation, meaning the subjective probability that it's a tough guy, will rise. Now, that part rings very, very true. I won't mention particular examples in any country, but that part of the model rings very true. However, this is the peculiar part. In the model, as soon as the central bank allows high inflation, even once, the public concludes with certainty that its central banker is a hopeless wet. Fortunately, that is not the way the real world works. That feature of the model strikes me as eccentric, at least, and probably downright silly. Why? Because in the real world, there are not just two types of central bankers, but many types. And furthermore, as I mentioned a few moments ago, random shocks cloud the mapping from outcomes back to types. You can't tell just by seeing one aberrant result on inflation that you have a wet central banker. For these and many other reasons, reputation in central banking, as in other venues, reputation is not like pregnancy. You really can have either a little or a lot. For example, the Bundesbank's entire reputation as an inflation fighter did not evaporate when German inflation rose from about zero in 1986 to the stratospheric rate of 4% in 1992. Nor should it have. In central banking circles, it is viewed as obvious that the accumulation and destruction of reputational capital behaves much more like adaptive than rational expectations. It doesn't jump all over the place. It evolves higher or lower. And here I think, I'm sure, the central bankers are much closer to the truth than the economic theorists. That's the first proposal. The second proposed cure for the alleged inflationary bias problem of monetary policy that has attracted the attention of many theorists is the idea of drawing up a contract, and you can interpret it either literally or figuratively, a contract between the central bank acting as agent and the political authorities, whom I shall parochially call Congress rather than Parliament, you'll forgive me, as the principal. The genesis of this idea is very simple. The Kidlin-Prescott analysis suggests that the incentives of decision makers are distorted toward excessive inflation. There were only two important words in that sentence: incentives and distorted. As soon as you say the words distorted incentives to economists, they reflexively, even if they are awoken in the middle of a deep sleep, think of taxes and subsidies to set things right. So Carl Walsh and Pershing and Tabellini have both proposed making the central banker's salary decline in proportion to inflation. And they show that this particular incentive scheme, making it hurt if they fail to bring inflation to zero, will induce, in the context of these theoretical models, will induce the central banker to behave optimally and not to go for high inflation. Obvious, you think. Yes, it is obvious. Now, what's wrong with that idea? Well, to start with, a small decrease in salary is probably not very much a very serious motivator for central bankers who are already voluntarily giving up a very large portion of their potential earnings to do public service. Let me put this bluntly and personally. While I served on the Federal Reserve Board, I had more or less a Walsh-type contract. I did. The Congress does not raise the salaries of American civil servants, because on the other side of the Atlantic, government is bad, and you're not supposed to pay people to be in government. So I had a fixed nominal salary, meaning that I lost 1% of my real salary for each percentage point of U.S. inflation. And the only way to stabilize my real salary would have been to produce zero inflation. When I say I, this was true, of course, of the entire Federal Reserve Board. But that meager $1,231 per year never once entered my thinking about monetary policy, I can assure you. It was dwarfed, completely dwarfed, by the other financial losses inherent in the job. Second objection. I think people that promote this theory really must face up to the embarrassing fact that virtually no central bank explicitly ties its salaries to economic performance. Not even in New Zealand, where there really is a formal contract between the governor of the Reserve Bank and the Minister of Finance. In New Zealand, the governor may be dismissed and thus, by the way, suffer a huge pay increase if inflation is too high. But he does not have his salary docked. Third, and finally, there is a severe conceptual problem with the party on the other side of this contract. In practice, the public, a concept that we imagine exists in theorizing, the public cannot serve as the principal in this contemplated contract. So Congress, or in this country, Parliament, must serve that role as a surrogate. But when you think about it, Congress is really an agent, not a principal. Don't members of Congress who have to stand for re-election have even stronger incentives to reach for short-term gains than central bankers do? If so, why would Congress ever propose a contract with the central bank to eliminate this inflationary bias? And even if they did, why would Congress then enforce the contract if the central bank deviated and thereby caused the little boom that helped them all to get reelected? Critics of government everywhere complain that elected officials focus myopically on the next election rather than on the long-run best interests of the nation. The vision in these theoretical models of a highly disciplined and far-sighted Congress curing the wayward ways of profligate and myopic central bankers is one of the greatest cases of cognitive dissonance that I have ever encountered. That brings me very naturally to the third proposed theoretical solution to the inflationary bias problem. And this is the one by far with the most practical appeal. About 10 years ago, Ken Rogoff cleverly suggested that if, in fact, there is an inflationary bias in monetary policy, the cure may lie in appointing to the central bank people that are more conservative than the public at large. Now, that really does have the ring of truth. Indeed, in the real world, it is hard to utter the noun central banker without finding the adjective conservative involuntarily coming right out of your mouth. To Rogoff, conservatism has a very specific meaning, and it's not the same meaning I used last night in the context of the Brainerd conservatism principle. To Rogoff, conservative means that this taste parameter alpha, indicating the aversion to inflation, which is presumed in the Barrow-Gordon analysis to be common to the central bank and the public. In Rogoff's analysis, what appointing a central banker means is finding people that have alphas, aversions to inflation, higher than those of the public, people that hate inflation more than the average citizen or average politicians do, and deliberately selecting those people for the central bank board or to be the central banker if there's only one central banker. The idea is that by doing this, one bias, which is the unrepresentative preferences of the central bank, cancel out the other bias, the bias towards high inflation that comes from time inconsistency. This model of Rogoff, he spelled out the equations that make that idea come true in theory. This analysis of Rogoff's is really, to me, a splendid illustration of the humorous definition of an economist, which is somebody who sees that something works in practice and wonders if it can work in theory. And Rogoff shows that it can work in theory. I think in practice there's very little doubt that central bankers in general, and successful inflation-fighting central bankers in particular, have indeed been quite conservative people by this or any other definition. Rogoff's model argues that this common practice is in fact wise, and he may be right. This is the one of the three proposed solutions that I find any truth in, and I find a considerable amount of truth in this one. Nonetheless, a few points about his proposed solution are worth making, briefly. First, the enhanced vigilance against inflation produced by conservative central bankers comes at a cost. It's not a free lunch. Real output and employment are more variable than they would be in the dynamically inconsistent solution. Second, you can have too much of a good thing. In Rogoff's model, and I believe in reality, it is possible to appoint a central banker who is too conservative. His alpha is too high. And such a central banker will not deliver the combination of inflation and output variability that society really wants. Such a central banker will concentrate too much on price stability. Third, a 1992 paper by Susan Lohman suggested an interesting amendment to the Rogoff approach, which improves upon the solution, but one which I think must be handled with care. Her idea is that there may be times when it is optimal for the government to overrule the decision of the conservative central banker. I want you to know that this was not written with modern Britain in mind. Lohman suggests that such actions, governments overruling the central bank, should be allowed, but only if the government pays a cost. In reality, in the real world, as opposed to the theoretical world, that cost might, for example, be the political heat that the Minister of Finance takes if she tries to overrule an important decision of the central bank governor. For example, the governor might resign in a huff, creating a furor, in the financial markets. Lohman's idea is correct both in economic theory and, importantly, in political theory. In a democracy, there do, after all, have to be some checks on the behavior of an overzealous central bank. But the practical application of this idea is tricky, to say the least. No central bank can claim to be independent if its monetary policy decisions can be reversed under other than extraordinary circumstances. So any real-world government that adopts the Lohman Amendment must ensure that politicians overrule the central bank extremely rarely. In the United States case, An act of Congress can, in fact, overrule a Federal Reserve decision, but this has never happened in the history of the Federal Reserve. In practice, Federal Reserve decisions are final. So what's the bottom line? Where does this extended discussion of rules versus discretion leave us in the real world as opposed to the theoretical world? While Kidlin and Prescott's insight, and it was an insight, points to a genuine difficulty for monetary policy, and some of the subsequent literature has been enlightening, I believe, as you can no doubt tell, that there is much less here than meets the eye. If there is strong agreement in society on both the positive aspects of a time inconsistency problem, in this case, the positive aspects of the Phillips curve, and the normative aspects of that time inconsistency problem. In this case, it's the social welfare function that I just took down. I should have left up for a moment more. And that's what Barrow and Gordon assume. In those cases, society should have relatively little difficulty in solving the problem, albeit imperfectly. For example, about 10 minutes ago, I suggested a very simple solution, ordering the central bank to act as if it prefers the natural rate of unemployment rather than any unemployment rate below the natural rate. In fact, nations and households seem to have found simple, practical ways to cope with a wide variety of potential dynamic inconsistency problems, ways that generally bear little resemblance to the solutions suggested by theorists. Some common examples of this are dealing with floodplains, avoiding capital levies, punishing your children when they misbehave, and giving final examinations in courses when it's obviously optimal both for professors and students to cancel the final exam at the last minute. In all of these cases, governments, norms of behavior, they do it by building reputations, and importantly, they do it by remembering that there are many tomorrows. Rarely does a society solve a time inconsistency problem by rigid pre-commitment or by creating incentive-compatible compensation schemes for decision makers. Instead, the rule is enlightened discretion. Similarly, the revealed preferences of many democratic societies are to deal with the problem of dynamic inconsistency in monetary policy. How? By legislating a long-term goal for the central bank, such as price stability, by giving discretion to non-political central bankers with long time horizons, and, as Rogoff suggested, an aversion to inflation. And then, having done all those things, hoping for the best. That is not a perfect solution, but it is not an obviously bad solution. And it is the solution that is used in the real world. Well, the overall subject of these three lectures is the interaction between academic theories of monetary policy and the actual practice of monetary policy by central banks. Tonight, I've dealt with three issues whose resolutions look to be quite different. In the case of choosing between interest rates and monetary aggregates as the policy instrument, the symbiosis between academia and the real world was extremely strong. Academic research, beginning with Poole, offered up sound and usable, that's important, usable advice, and practical central bankers took it to the benefit of all. Life imitated art. But in the case of the modern incarnation of the rules versus discretion debate based on time inconsistency, I have argued that things were starkly different. In my view, the academic literature has focused on either the wrong problem or a non-problem and has proposed a variety of solutions, excluding only Rogoff's conservative central bankers, that make little, if any, sense in the real world. Unsurprisingly, the academics in this context, have had little influence, if any, on central banking practice. Here, I am sure, art would be well advised to imitate life a bit more than it has. The third issue, the choice of the zero point that defines neutral monetary policy, is still unresolved. I've suggested tonight using an estimated neutral real interest rate, defined to be the real short rate that is consistent with constant inflation, as the dividing line between tight money and loose money. Now, neither the scholarly nor the practical jury has yet had enough time to consider and rule on this proposal. But I'm an economist, and I believe in market tests, and I'm willing to wait for the verdict. Thank you very much.
Professor Blinder, you can tell from the warmth of applause that many people will take away treasured memories of this lecture, and I must say my own treasured memory will be the tortured look on the faces of British economics professors as they struggle to make the imaginative leap over the water to a land in which, when academics moved to become central bankers, they would take a cut in salary. But you have agreed to answer questions.
First question is always the hardest. Yes, Charles.
Alan, your argument against the Walsh contract was based on the fact that your salary was so low, it didn't make any difference if it was cut a bit further. Do you think that is an appropriate salary?
Definitely not. What's the rest of it? Is that the whole question?
Well, if you pay central bank governors an appropriate base salary for success, say the equivalent of the CEO of General Motors, then you could introduce a Walsh contract and you would get the result. Wouldn't you?
Yes, in principle you would. The point I was making, but paying a salary like that is entirely beyond the realm of even remote realism. That, you know, what American CEOs get paid, more than British CEOs. This is a reversal of central bankers and CEOs. The point I was making is that people who take these jobs are not doing so primarily or even secondarily for pecuniary motivation. They are doing so because they believe in public service, and often in the case of the central bank especially, they believe in the importance of keeping inflation low. And so a 1% decline in real wages, even if it's a large sum of money, I think is a relatively small motivator compared to the true coin of the realm, which is the reputation you will take away from your service as a central banker. Did you do a good job or not? And then, of course, when you leave the central bank, you get a vast increase in salary. So you get your pecuniary rewards much later. But the reward you're looking for as a central banker, I think, has very little to do with money. And I just find it very hard to believe that even if larger sums were involved, this would be a serious motivator. Yes, in the back. No, that's a good point.
Could you hear at the top?
I'm going to paraphrase the question. The question had to do with the fact that I mentioned two ways that you might actually estimate the neutral rate of, a real rate of interest. One, which the questioner didn't mention, was solving out an econometric model for this concept. The second, which he did mention and ask a good question about, is to average the actual observed ex post real rates over a very long period of time, like 40 years. And the question was, Wouldn't it have been the case that over a long period of time like that, the real rate would have moved, since it's not a constant, and you lose that in the averaging? The answer is absolutely yes. That's why I prefer the first technique. The second technique is largely useful as a benchmark for the long-run average value of the neutral real interest rate, which you then have to be willing to adjust up or down depending on the circumstances. So, to pick a particularly concrete and relevant circumstance, in a period when the government budget is running a very large deficit, the neutral rate of interest for the central bank will be higher, say, than the 40-year average. But in a period where the government is running a quite low, all relative to GDP, deficit, then the neutral rate of interest ought to be below that historical average. And in particular, then you get some directional instruction as well, that as the government brings down its fiscal deficit, the central bank should be bringing down its target real interest rate. Yes, here in the balcony. Yes.
Supply, and they still have a monetary target.
Yes, they do.
They do argue that they consider more variables in addition.
Yes.
But the central issue that the Bundesbank talks about is the money supply.
Right. Yes. Did everyone hear the question? I had stated that central banks all over the world had abandoned money supply targeting, and the gentleman is raising the question, isn't it the case that the Bundesbank still talks about money supply targets regularly and treats them as an important input to their policy-making process? The answer is yes. The Bundesbank does talk about monetary targets regularly, but has not hesitated at all to move short-term interest rates in a way that seems contradicted by the behavior of the money supply, but is not contradicted by the behavior of the GDP gap and forecasts of inflation. So, for example, the Bundesbank has, in recent years, many times lowered interest rates despite quite high money growth rates. I don't think they were making a mistake. What they were looking at is the behavior of German inflation, which is very much under control and coming down. So I think while the Bundesbank uses the money supply targets as in a much greater way as a part of the surrounding prose of monetary policy, I think it's a mistake to think that they are coming anywhere close to targeting the money growth rate. And what they're doing is much closer to targeting the inflation rate. They're just one step, I was going to say behind. You can either say behind or ahead, whichever you want, of the Federal Reserve in this. The Federal Reserve has simply wiped away any use of the money supply targeting in explaining its monetary policy, although it still does report it to the Congress because there's a law that says you have to do so. The Bundesbank is speaking about money supply growth much more, but its actions are speaking much more loudly than its words. And 11% growth rates, say, of M3 have not been inflationary in Germany. And the Bundesbank would have been foolish to treat them as inflationary, and it wasn't foolish. It didn't treat them that way. Yes, way in the back.
Can you comment on the role of central bankers in emerging markets?
Yeah, the question, to which I'm tempted to answer no, but I won't, I'll say a little, was would I comment on the role of central banks in emerging markets, which often have extremely high rates of inflation, but also have high rates of unemployment. I'm tempted to answer your question no, because I'm far from an expert in that subject, but let me just say a couple of things. It is very often, to me, inflation at 100, 1,000% annual rates is a very different qualitative phenomenon than inflation at 2, 4, 6, 8, 12% annual rates. Very high inflation, say 1,000% a year, interferes so badly with the normal functioning of markets that it is more likely to cause economic dislocation, including unemployment, but many other types of economic dislocation as well, than it is to help, as a short-run Phillips curve would suggest. A little more inflation for a short period gets you lower unemployment. When you're talking about an economy experiencing 1,000% annual rate of inflation, bringing that inflation down, not necessarily to zero, but down even to the levels that the Western economies experienced at their worst, 10, 15, 25% inflation, is a very high priority and probably can be done without causing unemployment, and probably, in fact, it's very likely, I think, to reduce unemployment. It's a very different problem than most Western central bankers face when, if you decide that your inflation rate of 6% ought to be brought down to 2%, there's going to be almost for sure an unemployment cost to be paid. Oh, no, I think, no, this is, you have a much less subtle problem here in that very, very high inflation like that is almost always, I guess there must be some exceptions to this, but it's almost always caused by extremely large budget deficits being financed by printing money. And that points straight to the remedy. Lower budget deficit and don't finance it so much by printing money. A sledgehammer will do that job. When you get down to Western levels of inflation, you need a scalpel, not a sledgehammer. Yes, sir. Yeah. It's a good question. The question is, would I talk a little bit about using this measured real interest rate operationally, given the fact that if you pull it out of an econometric model, say, it's going to have presumably a very large, and by the way, I might add, it was implicit in your question, quite hard to compute standard error. It's a very complicated parameter of the model. I think it's a good question. To me, the answer is that you need to use this as a range. Now, the range, who knows what a two-standard error band around this concept is, though I think with some work, that's computable, probably by numerical simulation rather than, almost surely by numerical simulation rather than analytically. So you could compute it. And I haven't actually done that. When I was at the Fed, I never asked the Fed staff to do anything like that. Maybe I should, but I always used to use it as a range. So I used to, in the U.S. context, I used to think of the neutral real rate of interest, short rate, as being something between 1.75 and 2.5. So if you had something like 2.5, you looked about on the high side of the plausible range of neutrality. If you had something like 1.75, you're on the low side of the plausible range. And as you said, that's a bigger range than the gap, I'll presume, between what Gary Stern wanted to do two FOMCs ago and what Alan Greenspan wanted to do. I presume so, though I don't know. So it's not going to give you a number, and that's one of the reasons that I said you don't want to use this as a mechanical rule, but as a conceptual device for thinking about whether your policy is tight or loose, and among other things, for thinking about how your policy needs to be altered as other things, such as the fiscal deficit, change. Yes, in the middle here.
You mentioned that there may be too much of a good thing. In particular, there may be a central banker who has an alpha that is too high.
Yes.
So you're implicitly assuming that there is some optimal alpha.
Yes.
Some optimal inflation rate that the central bank should aim for.
Right.
On which inflation rate central bank
Yes.
In,
I will. First, in the context of these, the question had to do with central bankers that I had mentioned possibly being too concerned with inflation reduction, having an alpha that was too high and therefore being too conservative to produce the social optimum. In those models, the desired rate of inflation, which I took to be zero, is just taken to be a given. And when you're choosing your central banker, it's about how devoted he or she is to getting to that and then maintaining that rate, whatever it is, whether it be 2% or 0%. So the alpha is different from the target. The alpha becomes relevant when the economy is either starts away from the target or gets shocked away from the target. How vigorously do you pull it back? You raised a different question about the inflation target itself, and I think it's a good question, and it involves measurement. It should involve measurement of the social costs of relatively low inflation, right? How much, if anything, does society gain from having 0% inflation rather than, say, 3% inflation? This question is extremely controversial right now. There has been recent, quite interesting academic research on both sides of this question, arguing on the one hand, some people, not the same people, one group arguing that the social benefits of reducing inflation from 2 or 3 to 0 are enormous. Another group arguing, in fact, that not only are they not enormous, but they're negative, that you actually do social harm by going from, say, 2 or 3% inflation to zero. So I think that issue is wide open at the moment. Go right here.
You said that the Congress is allowed to overrule a decision made by the Fed.
Yes.
But they never did it. However, I would like to know if, as the vice chairman of the Federal Bank, any felt any pressure from the board of trustees.
Yeah. The question was, while the Congress doesn't actually overrule the Fed, did I ever feel pressure from the political side on the Federal Reserve? I would say no. I was only on the central bank a short period of time, so this is not an answer for all seasons. While I was on the central bank, I think there was very little true pressure. There was plenty of complaining from Congress about the increases in the Fed's interest rate during 1994. And before every FOMC meeting between spring of 94 into the winter of 94-5, a letter signed by N congressmen, N running from 20 to 80, arrived in Alan Greenspan's office urging the FOMC not to raise interest rates. But I never felt that that was serious political pressure, and we never listened to those letters, and we never paid any consequences for not listening. Now, there have been other periods in Federal Reserve history where the political pressure was much tougher, and there have been other instances in other countries where the political pressure, even on a putatively independent central bank, was much tougher. There's no such thing as absolute independence in a democratic, well, it doesn't even have to be. Why say a democratic society? In a society that is led by I was about to say elected, some of these are not elected, political figures. There's no such thing as absolute independence. But in my experience at the Federal Reserve, the degree of independence, political independence, is extremely high.
Professor Blender, thank you very much for the lecture and the questions. There will be time for more questions tomorrow night. We look forward to your next lecture.